This episode contains strong themes that some listeners may find distressing. The historical events in this show touch on the subjects of chronic illness, death, suicide, homophobia, sexual acts, drug use, and some explicit language.
The 1980s were important and trying times for Aotearoa. Many look back to this time for the fashion and the music, but it was also a period of bold protest and activism, political reform, economic disasters, and more. You may have learned about some of these events in school. The Springboks Tour, the Rainbow Warrior, Māori Language Act of 1987, all important parts of our history that people should know and reflect on. In this series, you'll learn something that isn't taught in schools, but it should be. A story that should sit alongside all of our most famous events in history, involving a group of brave people that Aotearoa should be immensely proud of. Perhaps it's a testament to how well they did that most don't know their names, but it's time to change that. This is Our Forgotten Epidemic, a six-part story about Aotearoa New Zealand's response to HIV and AIDS, and some of the many brave individuals who changed the course of history. I'm your host, Dr. Jason Myers, and I've been honoured to have been a part of the HIV response in Aotearoa for nearly two decades. This is part three, Our Communities Take Action.
The story of Tutane Kai and Tiki. Ka aroha atu a Tutane Kai ki a Tiki, ka mea atu ki a whakaue, ka mate ahau I te aroha ki tōku hoa ki a Tiki. Tutane Kai loved Tiki and said to whakaue, "I am stricken with love for my friend, for Tiki." From Ngā Tama Ārangi, The Sons of Heaven, written in 1849 by Wī Maihi Te Rangi Kāheke of the Ngāti Rangi Wewehi tribe of Rotorua.
You've just heard part of the legend of Hine Moa and Tutane Kai. Many scholars interpret the relationship discussed here between the hero of the story, Tutane Kai, and his friend Tiki, as a traditional example of what Te Reo Māori is known as takatāpui, a same-sex relationship. Today, takatāpui is a much broader and more personalised term used by Māori to identify a range of gender and sexual identities. According to historical sources, Māori society in pre-colonial Aotearoa was mostly accepting of sexual and gender diversity. But after the British colonised Aotearoa and it became part of the British Empire known as New Zealand in 1840, homosexual acts between men became punishable by death. The law went through a series of changes over the following 120 years. In 1867, under the Offences Against the Person Act, the penalty of death changed from execution to merely life imprisonment. In 1893, all sex between men became classified as sexual assault, even when consensual. In 1961, the Crimes Act reduced the penalties for these activities by removing the punishments of flogging and whipping. Although various organisations and politicians had attempted law reform over the years, by the time HIV and AIDS started to reach New Zealand, none of these attempts had been successful. All anal sex, including consensual anal sex between both homosexual and heterosexual people, was unbelievably still illegal. In 1972, a new wave of gay liberation picked up steam with the Māori lesbian activist Dr. Ngāhuia Te Awe Kotuku. She had been denied a United States visa on the grounds of sexual deviance. Her response to this discrimination was a series of lectures and protests around Aotearoa, calling on gay people to start a gay liberation. Protests, such as the one you're about to hear, began to take place across Aotearoa.
2, 4, 6, 8, gay is just as good as straight.
2, 4, 6, 8, gay is just as good as straight.
3, 5, 7, 9, lesbians are mighty fine.
Lesbians are mighty fine.
Following on from this, in 1985, nearly 150 years after homosexual acts became illegal, in conjunction with various gay rights groups, Labour Member of Parliament Fran Wild developed the Homosexual Law Reform Bill. Here she is introducing the legislation.
Mr. Speaker, I move that leave be given to introduce the Homosexual Law Reform Bill. Mr. Speaker, at the outset, I want to make it quite clear that this bill is not a government or party measure. It is a private member's bill, and as such, I would ask all members to listen to the debate and the issues carefully and to make their decision on the information, the real information.
The bill was comprised of two parts. First, it sought to decriminalise sexual activity between men, as well as heterosexual anal sex, whilst providing protection of minors. Second, it would be made illegal to discriminate on the grounds of sexual orientation. It was presented to Parliament as a members' bill on the 8th of March 1985, and was one in a series of attempts to reform the laws surrounding homosexuality in New Zealand. It was also the beginning of a long, often bitter fight that would dominate the nation's awareness for the next year. The clip you are about to hear contains homophobic and discriminatory language, and may be upsetting to some listeners. If you'd like to fast forward a little, I'd completely understand.
You're down the drain. You're back into the sewers. You're back into the sewers where you come from. What we're looking at here, I don't love homosexuals. As far as I'm concerned, you can stay in the gutter. 95%.
While it's awful to give such bigotry airtime, I also believe it's important to play that clip, simply so listeners today can get a sense of how prevalent and widely accepted such horrific discrimination was in New Zealand in the 80s. Norman Jones, the Speaker, was a Member of Parliament for the National Party, one of New Zealand's major political parties. Can you imagine being a queer person and hearing that sort of rhetoric coming out of Parliament in Aotearoa today? Thankfully, the brave people on the other side of the debate weren't prepared to back down.
What do we want?
Gay rights!
When do we want them?
Now!
What do we want?
Gay rights!
When do we want them?
Now!
I'm going to come back to homosexual law reform soon, but before I do that, I want to talk about some of the other advocacy work that was happening in New Zealand in the 16 months that followed the bill's introduction to Parliament. Let's go now to Warren Lindbergh, who was an important part of our story. Warren had been a schoolteacher in Ōtara and was a passionate advocate for the rights of marginalised young people. Sometime in the early 80s, perhaps prompted by Fran Wild's bill, Warren realised, in his words, that he needed to deal with his own sense of oppression.
So I joined the Auckland Gay Task Force, working on Fran Wild's bill in 1985.
While Warren was becoming an active member in the gay rights community, he was simultaneously hearing of another issue that those people around him were discussing.
There was conversations about not only homosexual law reform, but this disease, which was inevitably coming here.
By this stage, Bruce Burnett had already run a very effective lobbying campaign, travelling up and down the country educating people. In September of 1985, 3 months after Bruce died, the AIDS Support Network changed its name to the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. The goal, however, stayed the same as it had been when he was alive, to provide care and support to Kiwis affected by HIV and AIDS. With the government funding they received prior to Bruce's death, they were in the process of setting up a new clinic. Warren, becoming aware that AIDS was coming to New Zealand and actually was of immediate concern to him and his community, started to take notice of this fledgling organisation that seemed to be doing some important work. But although they were recognised by the government and had begun to receive financial support, the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, the NZAF, was facing growing pressure from the community to address the barriers that were preventing access for those who needed their services most.
They reached a point where they actually had a government grant, $100,000, and an organisation with a board of trustees They did not at that point have anybody open about living with HIV or AIDS on the board. There were a couple of openly gay people, but otherwise there were some people who I later realised had AIDS, but they weren't disclosing it at that point in time.
In 1986, after a short time in the role, the Foundation's first director, Neville Crichton, stepped down. Warren Limburg, with his relevant mix of personal and professional experience, jumped at the opportunity to lead.
I was A, I was openly gay. B, I had some experience of working with communities and volunteers. C, I had some political credibility with the Labour Party anyway. But Labour had come into power, fortunately, at the right time. And I didn't panic. So I got the job and started in 1986.
Newly in the role, Warren could see the passion and potential in the committed board of the NZAF, but he also saw some challenges ahead. Challenges that didn't just affect the foundation, but the community at large.
The gay community had no experience of establishing an organisation that was open about being an organisation. Even if you were running a bar, you were complying with laws that didn't actually enable you to be openly a gay bar. We were good at running, no, we weren't even good at running discos in those days. Hard to believe, isn't it? And deep, deep suspicion of authorities of any kind.
The NZAF and Warren as its director had a monumental job ahead of them. What they wanted was to unite and empower the gay community so they could work together to protect themselves against the looming threat of the HIV and AIDS crisis. But before they could do that, they needed to earn the trust of the community. Luckily, it didn't take long before an opportunity presented itself to Warren to do just that.
On my desk on my first day, there were letters from the Ministry of Health congratulating me on my appointment to the job, inviting me to go to Wellington. They didn't invite me to meet a ministry person in Auckland. They thought I should go to Wellington. But the crux of it was going to be my meeting with the senior people running the sexual health services. And there were two women, one from Christchurch and one from Auckland. They were obviously very professionally highly regarded, and they were angry because they thought the money for clinics, for people with HIV and AIDS was going to be done through the sexual health service. And this is what the ministry, it was its starting point. The sexual health service can deal with this. Except for the $100,000, which was to be for preventing AIDS in the gay community. I thought, you know, you've got a fatal, infectious, sexually transmissible disease heading here, and with a population in hiding, and you've given us $100,000 and to be told that's it, there won't be any more.
Warren, who had experience keeping his cool in meetings like these, found staying calm a lot harder as the discussion wore on.
The crux of it for me came when they started talking about risk groups. They'd talked about hard-to-reach groups. And I said, what do you mean? I don't know what you mean. And she said, well, you know, people, homosexuals. I said, well, there's me. I'm not hard to reach. That's me. I can reach homosexuals quite easily.
He won that argument, and the meeting ended, with the NZAF being allowed, for now, to keep the money. But the larger debate wasn't over yet.
The next thing that really happened, I had my first encounter with the media. And I was suddenly summoned to a television interview. I was being interviewed to counter the case that was being made by the head of the sexual health service in Auckland, that the money should have gone to the sexual health service, not to the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. And so I listened to her, and we knew each other because we'd met in Wellington. And when she had said her piece, I said, do you think the lives of gay men are less valuable than the lives of other people? She said, of course not. I said, and well, in that case, why should we not be enabled to have our own service where we can guarantee that anyone who comes will be treated with respect?
A gay man standing up for gay rights on national TV? This was a big deal in the 80s. Remember, homosexual acts were illegal. In those days, a man who openly had sex with men could find it incredibly difficult to hold a public position, to be a teacher, a government official, or in the defence forces. And here was an erudite, well-educated man who was openly gay and who was willing to stand in front of the nation and argue for the right for gay men to support one another. By his own admission, Warren had been relatively unknown in the gay community prior to this interview. He suddenly found himself thrust into the spotlight. Gay men all over New Zealand began contacting him, congratulating him and thanking him for what he had done. So, not only did the New Zealand AIDS Foundation get to keep the money, they had also taken the beginning steps towards earning the trust and respect of the communities they existed to protect.
In what I learned about just being polite and calm and asserting our rights. So that was really important, because this whole business about the gay community's ability to trust the AIDS Foundation, let alone the Sexual Health Service or the Ministry of Health, was absolutely fundamental to our success. And so being an openly gay man who can calmly, quietly and calmly deal with a media interview that advocates successfully for our rights was an important part of building that trust.
This ethos, as we've just heard, would go on to shape the culture of the foundation in the years to come. He had passed the first hurdle, but he still had an enormous job ahead of him, leading the NZAF into the future. To do that, they needed some concrete goals. Warren knew that to be successful in this work, he would need to unite not just the gay community, but all those who were threatened by HIV and AIDS. This would mean working closely with all of the key populations most affected.
We actually divided our programs into three. One was prevention, one was support, and one was human rights. So we had three major policy initiatives. One was to complete homosexual law reform. The second was to get decriminalisation of possession of needles and syringes that people you might use for injecting drug use. And the third was decriminalisation of prostitution.
In a particularly potent, unlucky series of circumstances, AIDS mostly seemed to be threatening communities already on the margins, or who were outright discriminated against. People who had reasons to stay secret. In many ways, this secrecy was to HIV's advantage and was what allowed the virus to spread so rapidly. But the resilient and resourceful people of these communities saw an opportunity to not just protect themselves, but to embrace the challenge as a catalyst for positive change. Around the country and around the world, groups of previously shunned communities were standing up, forcing the public to take notice and demanding that their governments protect their health, a basic human right. Here's Bill Logan, who you'll remember from the first episode as one of the founders of NZAF.
When I was in about 1984, I was on some sort of panel discussion, and someone asked on television, and someone asked about the transmission by needles, and I said, well, the same principles apply, you know. We can deal with HIV among gay men by legalising and giving out condoms, and we can deal with HIV among drug users by legalising and giving out needles.
In the mid-80s, reports started coming in of cases of AIDS among people who injected drugs overseas, and the foundation had started fielding questions on this. Meanwhile, two people who were openly living with HIV and who also injected drugs, Roger Wright and Gary McGrath, banded together with other injecting drug users and health professionals to found the New Zealand IV League. Like a lot of the people you're learning about in this series, both Roger and Gary showed an incredible amount of courage. Not only had they disclosed publicly that they were living with HIV, they also revealed that they injected drugs. Together, with the other members of the IV League, they advocated for the decriminalisation of needles and syringes, and for the formation of a needle exchange program. The aims of the IV League aligned very closely with one of the early goals of the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, and so they began working with the IV League to help them advance their cause. Here's Warren.
When we went to the AIDS Advisory Committee and said you've got to do something to prevent injecting drug use transmission, we recommend decriminalisation of the instruments, because having needles and syringes for the purpose of injecting drug use was criminal, and people could be arrested for just having them on their possession.
The AIDS Advisory Committee was a group made up of community leaders and medical experts who advised the Minister of Health. Because they knew their advice would be taken seriously by the government, the committee needed robust scientific evidence before making their recommendations.
And so the AIDS Advisory Committee said, what research have you got? And we said, none. How long do you want to wait for the death list? They said, go away and see what you can come back with. So we went away and we found some research from comparing Edinburgh and Liverpool, where the police in Edinburgh had been rigid about enforcing the law. The police in Liverpool had not. The result was Edinburgh had an AIDS problem, Liverpool didn't.
Meanwhile, and while the debate around needle exchanges raged elsewhere, the now Dame Catherine Healy was a sex worker in Wellington. Recognising the threat AIDS presented to sex workers, she began to arrange informal meetings with other sex workers around the country to together decide the best way to respond to the shared threats facing them. In the mid-80s, the laws governing sex work were confusing and inconsistently prosecuted. Sex workers, pimps and brothel keepers could be prosecuted at any time. The only party in the equation who was always safe from prosecution was the client. Indicative of who made the laws, perhaps? With the NZAF's backing, the informal meetings turned into an organisation, the New Zealand Prostitutes Collective. As their profession was illegal, they had to find creative ways to reach other colleagues across the country. They talked to people in other massage parlours, reached out to the street-based sex workers, and began to form a coalition. And as they did so, they began to be noticed. Here's Dame Catherine Healy.
The AIDS Foundation was saying, we need to get the sex workers involved, and nobody knew how to do that. So we had formed our little network and we're just emerging, really. So I remember going to a meeting with people from the Department of Health and the AIDS Task Force, you know, asked the sex workers and what we were doing. And then they said, we could give you some funding if you want to do your own education program, and offered $35,000.
Accepting money from the government obviously had some conditions attached, and the group weren't convinced they were ready for that. As a historically marginalised, criminalised community, it's easy to assume they had a strong, rational distrust of authority.
So we went away, and I remember there were about nine of us in my flat, and we all sat on the floor and were smoking cigarettes like crazy, and we talked about the letter we would write to the Department of Health and the things that we would do with the $35,000. And somebody had said, look, make it $50,000. We didn't actually know if we wanted involvement because we didn't want to lose our identity.
In the end, they decided to take the money, but they made sure it was on their own terms. They set up a clinic in Wellington's Cuba Street, from where they launched the educative magazine Siren.
The funding came through and it was October. We got a cheque, I think, for $5,000, something like that. The first cheque arrived. And we went out and we got a lease on a building in Upper Cuba Street, and we didn't have any waged staff, so we were all volunteers.
Early on, it was understood that condoms would play an important role in the prevention of HIV transmission. So one of the first things the Prostitutes Collective did with this funding was set up a condom distribution scheme. In an Aotearoa where condoms are so ubiquitous, it's hard for most of us to imagine the barriers sex workers in the 80s faced in sourcing them.
You know, the condoms were about $18 a packet for 12 in the 80s. And we'd be going through them, and it was incredibly embarrassing to be going in and getting condoms. It was like you had a big W on your forehead and everyone knew you were a sex worker. And so all of us hated getting our condoms, you know, because we felt so exposed. And there weren't many options for getting condoms. That was the other thing. Like, a lot of places didn't carry them, and it was pretty, you know, it was pretty wild west.
Back then, as well as not being accessible, they weren't widely used for the prevention of anything but pregnancy. You could go to the doctors to get a script for them, but even then they were wildly expensive. Initially lobbying for condoms to be available in supermarkets and gas stations, their efforts back then are largely the reason why they're so accessible today. A great thing that was happening at this time was that all these advocacy groups, recognising that they were fighting the same fight, started to join together.
And then we met also with the Needle Exchange. You know, we wanted relationships with them and they hadn't got going, so we said, why don't you come in and share with us?
The Prostitutes Collective and the Needle Exchange began sharing an office on Upper Cuba Street, Wellington. And the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, although still small, with Warren's focus on community, had started to become a sort of mentor to these other organisations. But even with all this support and advocacy, these three populations were still facing a massive uphill struggle. The media, though largely helpful to NZAF, were not as respectful to the Prostitutes Collective. Headlines such as "Hookers Hurry Home" painted an intentionally panic-inducing picture of sex workers with HIV rushing back to New Zealand to infect unsuspecting Kiwis. Unpredictable police were still prosecuting people who used drugs, were still sending the Vice Squad to raid brothels and the meeting places of men who have sex with men, seemingly when the mood would strike. You can see the pattern here, the so-called disease of the H's, the homosexuals, hookers and heroin users, was affecting those people most marginalised by society. And this marginalisation was also contributing to the spread of HIV because it disincentivised healthy practices like needle swaps and safer sex practices. Now, nothing in society exists in a vacuum. If a virus is spreading through underground communities, left unchecked, it will soon enough spread beyond those confines. HIV and AIDS was never just going to be a gay problem, or something that only affected sex workers or people who used drugs. But the failing of our society was that we needed to see evidence of the larger threat it presented to the wider population before we were motivated to take action. Eve Van Graafhorst was born on July the 17th, 1982, in New South Wales, Australia. She was a premature baby, which meant that she required 11 blood transfusions in order to save her life. Tragically, at 3 years old, Eve was diagnosed with HIV. One of the transfusions used when she was a baby had been contaminated. Eve became one of the first Australian children known to be infected with HIV. Eve's mother, Gloria, was not obligated to tell her daughter's preschool about Eve's diagnosis, but, thinking it was the right choice, decided to. The backlash the family faced from this disclosure was immediate, and Eve was forced to withdraw from her class. The Australian media picked up on the story, and her family soon became household names. They faced overwhelming discrimination from the public, neighbours, and even former friends. This mirrored the experiences of children affected by HIV worldwide. Desperate to get away, and hoping they might find a more caring reception elsewhere, the Van Graafhorsts relocated to Hawke's Bay, New Zealand, where Gloria had grown up. There, the family found themselves welcomed by the Hastings community, and Eve was afforded a relatively normal life. Dr. Richard Meach was the infectious diseases specialist in Hawke's Bay. Alongside Dr. Rod Ellis Pegler, he helped lead the first clinical response to HIV and AIDS in New Zealand. He also happened to be Eve's doctor.
She was really a non-threatening face to HIV and AIDS. And because she had been more or less hounded out of Australia, the New Zealand population felt very good about their attitudes around Eve.
The late Paul Holmes, who was a very famous New Zealand broadcaster, picked up Eve's story. He and Eve became friends and he helped raise awareness of her situation.
Yeah, well, Paul Holmes, of course, really made Eve the national darling. There were times when Eve would be in hospital and we'd be juggling medications and let her go out on the Thursday or the Friday, and then bingo, and Paul Holmes on Monday night, she'd be up the top of Mount Cook or something.
Eve's story was widely reported in the media, both here and overseas. She became known as Angel Eve and even received a letter, an autographed picture from Princess Diana. Eve's arrival changed the way AIDS was perceived in New Zealand.
And so each country more or less had a figure, a face that HIV and AIDS was presented to the general population. We, as far as I know, were the only country that had a child's face. Kaposi's sarcoma is a very disfiguring condition, and so there are adults with things like that that the general media would, or public I should say, would struggle to get some sort of empathy with, some sort of association, whereas with a child like Eve, and she was given a huge amount of publicity by Paul Holmes over the years, then New Zealand had this really very non-threatening, we're proud of what New Zealand has done, sort of model for HIV.
Eve lived for many years longer than expected, but sadly couldn't hold on forever. Dr. Richard Meach remembers the last time he saw Eve.
And I remember going to visit little Eve, and she was terribly ill, terminally ill, and it was obvious that she would die in the next day or two. And I talked to her mother, Gloria. We looked at Eve and discussed what could or could not be done to manage symptoms. And I was just going out the door thinking that's the last time I'll see Eve alive, when this little child's voice from the bed says, "I love you, Dr. Meach."
She died on the 20th of November, 1993, aged 11. After her death, Eve's mother Gloria said, "There are not many people that can face death with their eyes open, but she did." Eve's journey touched the lives of many people, both in Aotearoa and abroad. Although the subsequent media coverage she received had an overall positive impact on raising the awareness of AIDS at the time, there is a darker side to the outpouring of love and positive attention she received. Eve, as a baby at the time of acquiring HIV, was the ultimate innocent victim. And Kiwis, more credit to us, have a reputation for getting behind causes like hers. Eve was welcomed into New Zealand with open arms, and for that, we should be proud. At the same time, there is something troubling in idealising the innocent victim, because by saying there is an innocent victim, it's implying that there are guilty or deserving victims. And so, by publicly mourning over a child with AIDS, while ignoring the gay men, people who injected drugs, sex workers and others who were overwhelmingly the majority of those affected, the media was effectively saying that those people weren't as worthy of the support and grief that Angel Eve was. But still, it's undeniable that Eve's story forced the threat of HIV and AIDS into the spotlight, and any attention was welcome at this stage, however difficult it might have been to swallow for those who had already lost so much and yet were not being acknowledged at all. Let's go back to the homosexual law reform bill.
1, 2, 3, 4, we want to change the law. 1, 2, 3, 4, we want to change the law.
As you heard earlier, in the early 80s, New Zealand still had some archaic, colonial-era laws policing homosexuality. For years, gay rights activists and other supporters had been lobbying to change these laws, without much success. The threat of the AIDS epidemic, however, meant that this fight took on a whole new urgency and gained new, powerful supporters, like MP Fran Wild.
Mr. Speaker, if we are to effectively combat the spread of AIDS in New Zealand, we must remove the criminal label from the prime target group and ensure that they feel secure enough to participate in a public education program.
Unfortunately, homophobia was also rife, including throughout the ranks of those in positions of power and service, like politicians and the police. In New Zealand, the medical community, social workers, and some politicians saw the impossibility of preventing the spread of a disease in a community that was in hiding. Even the New Zealand media made an effort to act responsibly, unlike in some other countries. Here's Dr. Richard Meach again, the infectious diseases expert from Hawke's Bay.
I used to think of AIDS as challenging us on homosexuality, injecting drug users and commercial sex workers, three problems that society was not comfortable with, had just simply put in the too difficult basket.
As the threat of AIDS was primarily towards communities that were easily discriminated against, conversations around homosexuality, sex work and the use of drugs were often emotionally fraught and lacking in reason. The medical community became concerned that politicians would weaponize these issues by manipulating voters in order to further their own political agendas.
Our biggest concern was that this would become a political issue. So one of our very early things that we did was we sent a small group to Parliament to meet with the health caucus of all political parties, with the plea being made, look, this is a big enough problem as it stands. Please do not make it a political issue.
Of course, changing a law is inherently a political issue, and the year that followed Fran Wild's introduction of the Homosexual Law Reform Bill was rife with dirty politics and extreme, often discriminatory opinions. But it was also a time of passion, liberation, and unexpected support. Here's Bruce Kilmister, who was a founding member of the New Zealand AIDS Foundation and was active in campaigning for reform.
We didn't have to dig far with anybody to find that they did have gay connections, either gay friends or gay members of their family, or that they knew gay people. And whilst people took a very public stance against homosexuality, when you spoke to them personally, they were quite supportive.
Homosexual law reform had been discussed in Parliament before. The aptly named New Zealand Homosexual Law Reform Society had actually presented a petition to Parliament 17 years earlier in 1968, which was subsequently dismissed. Soon after, MP Venn Young had attempted to legalise homosexual acts under the Crimes Amendment Bill in 1974, before MP Warren Freer had proposed changes to the law in 1979 and 1980. Here's Phil Parkinson, another of the NZAF's founders who you met in episode one.
We'd had two or three attempts at a homosexual law reform bill previously. They had failed. And if we were going to do this again, we had to make sure we got it right, because if it went badly wrong again, the consequences were just too dire to contemplate.
A problem with the first two propositions, aside from New Zealand's prevailing homophobic attitudes, was that gay rights groups refused to provide their support due to legitimate concerns they held over the proposed age of consent. In an attempt to succeed where others failed, Fran Wild worked closely with gay rights groups to develop the 1985 proposal. Here's Tony Hughes, who was the scientific director for NZAF.
We argued quite strongly for an equal age of consent. We were completely agnostic as to what the age was, like if we didn't want it to be 21, but we'd have been happy if it had been 18 for everybody. I wouldn't have died in the ditch over there. Never wanted it to be below 16, but did not want a 21 age of consent for gay sex and a 16 age of consent for heterosexual sex, because that's just fundamentally chucking young gay people to the wolves.
As Tony said, they were determined to create legislation that wouldn't treat the rights of gay people differently from straight people. It seemed as if the opposition, mostly the religious right, wanted to do the exact opposite. Here's the awful Norman Jones again, attempting to spread more of his propaganda.
If this bill is passed in its present form, homosexuals from overseas will come to New Zealand in their thousands. New Zealand will be looked upon as the mecca for homosexuality, for sodomy. What an attraction it's going to be to them. The Minister of Tourism will be able to advertise New Zealand to homosexuals throughout the world. Come to New Zealand for sun, for sun, for scenery and safe sodomy.
Sounds like a pretty effective tourism campaign to me. In Aotearoa, we generally like to consider ourselves to be forward-thinking and progressive. But every so often, something comes along that forces us to confront the less accepting parts of our nation. Homosexual law reform was one such moment. The debates across the country were bitter and fierce and took around 16 months to process through Parliament. In opposition to the homosexual law reform bill, politician Peter Tate and businessman Keith Hay formed the Coalition of Concerned Citizens, the CCC. They argued that legalising homosexuality would lead to a decline in modern standards, whatever that means, and would encourage the spread of AIDS, and announced they would organise a petition against homosexual law reform. They had the lofty goal of reaching 1 million signatures, a third of New Zealand's population at the time.
Keith Hay is the organiser of the petition and has clearly stated in the New Zealand Times on the 7th of April that he does not know anything about homosexuality.
Of course not!
He says, in fact, that he had not actually heard of it until a couple of months ago. However, this man is prepared, in his ignorance, to organise a nationwide campaign against a group of people whom he knows nothing about.
The Coalition of Concerned Citizens, the CCC, during this time must have become rather desperate in their collecting of their 1 million signatures, because parents and teachers began complaining of children, some as young as six, being harassed at the school gates, pressured into signing the petition. The CCC's dirty tactics were picked up by the New Zealand media.
There's a front page picture of an 8-year-old girl who was given a petition opposing homosexual law reform at a Wellington church. Her mother told the Dominion she's seething about the incident and ripped up the petition.
Keith Hay, when confronted with these reports, refused to address them. The CCC presented their petition in the form of 91 cardboard boxes delivered to the steps of Parliament. There was supposedly one for every electorate in New Zealand. They claimed to have collected over 800,000 signatures. When the boxes were opened, however, some were almost empty, and duplicates of names were found on some forms. The petition was rejected by the Parliament's Petitions Committee. Here's Warren Lindbergh on how the NZAF responded to the CCC's propaganda.
My job was to go around Parliament and do a last round of lobbying to persuade wavering MPs that a decriminalisation of homosexual acts would not encourage the spread of AIDS, which was the argument the right wing and the religious advocacy had been saying, oh, you're freeing them up, You're letting them do more. They're going to have more unsafe sex and we're all going to die. So our argument, of course, was you can't get people in hiding either to acquire the information or to take steps to change their behaviour. And we'll continue to expose people to demonisation, oppression of various discrimination, and being beaten up.
On the 9th of July 1986, the bill was put to the final vote.
Here is the third reading and vote.
The question is that the Homosexual Law Reform Bill be now read a third time. The ayes are 49, the noes are 44. It will be read a third time.
Bruce Kilmister was there in Parliament when the votes passed. Here he is talking about a moment he shared with MP Trevor Mallard.
We were sitting in the gallery at Parliament and watching the final debate before the Speaker called for the vote. And Trevor Mallard, we got to know quite a few of the MPs because on the selection panels, when they hosted when they were up here in Auckland, we would talk with some of the committee and we'd have a meal together or talk with each other. But I remember Trevor looking up at me and saying, acknowledging me and saying, "We've got the votes." He mouthed that, "We've got the votes, we've got the votes." It was great, but until you actually hear the Speaker say that the legislation has won, then we celebrated, of course. Firstly down in Fran's office with her and all the MPs came around. It was a great party.
After 146 years, this archaic and discriminatory law had been overturned. Finally, gay men and heterosexual people were legally allowed to have anal sex without fear of being imprisoned. Here's Tony Hughes.
And as you know, we managed to get that whole thing together in the end, and the religious right did not succeed in turning HIV into a weapon. We framed the HIV epidemic as an opportunity. In order to deal with HIV, we needed an accessible out community.
After the success of the Homosexual Law Reform Bill, NZAF and other HIV and AIDS activists moved quickly to campaigning to reform other parts of New Zealand law in the continuing fight against HIV and AIDS. Not long afterwards, on the 17th of December 1987, Parliament enacted legislation which resulted in New Zealand becoming the first country in the world to provide a national, state-sponsored needle exchange programme. The second part of the proposed Homosexual Law Reform Bill, making it illegal to discriminate against someone on the grounds of sexual orientation, was eventually incorporated into the New Zealand Human Rights Act of 1993. The Act also outlawed discrimination on the basis of somebody's HIV status by making it illegal to discriminate on the grounds of having organisms capable of causing illness in the body. However, reformation of the laws surrounding sex work was apparently too much for pre-millennial Aotearoa. Although NZPC kept up a relentless fight to change the law, it wouldn't be for another decade that solicitation was finally decriminalised in 2003. The work these brave advocacy groups did at the beginning of the HIV and AIDS crisis had an immeasurable effect upon the health and safety of the whole of New Zealand. It's largely thanks to them that we didn't see out-of-control epidemics unfold on our shores that other countries like America, Scotland and even Australia endured during the worst years of the pandemic. Even so, although they had spent all this time readying themselves and putting safeguards in place to protect the people of Aotearoa, how could they ever truly be ready for what was still to come? Thanks for listening to Our Forgotten Epidemic, a show about Aotearoa New Zealand's response to HIV and AIDS and some of the many brave individuals who changed the course of history. Burnett Foundation Aotearoa is proud to be able to tell part of this important story from the perspectives of some truly remarkable people. And we want to acknowledge there's so much more than we can tell in this short series. Our Forgotten Epidemic was produced by Wavelength Creative in collaboration with Burnett Foundation Aotearoa. Written and researched by Alyssa Partington, Matt Bain, and myself, Jason Myers. All music composed by Alex Cox. Many of the voices you've heard in this episode are from a series of interviews conducted by Dr. Cheryl Weir in 2019 for the New Zealand AIDS Foundation Oral History Project. Thanks to Pride NZ for allowing us to use portions of an interview with Bruce Kilmister. You can listen to this interview in full, alongside many others, at pridenz.co.nz. Thanks to Ian Kaihe-Wetting for the reading of Tutanekai and Tiki. The audio concerning homosexual law reform you heard in this episode was recorded in Parliament House and is held at the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, Te Pūranga Takatāpui o Aotearoa, Legends. The radio clips you heard in this episode were from a Radio Gala Auckland broadcast, now held at the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, Te Pūranga Takatāpui o Aotearoa, Legends. Special thanks to our test listeners, including staff living with HIV at Burnett Foundation Aotearoa, Gareth Watkins, the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, and pridenz.co.nz. Special thanks also goes to Peter Davis for his excellent book, Intimate Details and Vital Statistics, AIDS, Sexuality and the Social Order in New Zealand. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Our Forgotten Epidemic, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Dr. Jason Myers. Join me in the next episode of Our Forgotten Epidemic.